you see two opposing armies, and right in the middle is this chariot. That is where Bhagavad Gita is being spoken. So you see these huge armies, and in the middle is this chariot. So the scene starts out ordinarily. A question, what's happening on the battlefield? This is not an ordinary battle in which this extraordinary text of enlightenment is going to be spoken. This is a battle between extended family members. Not like you're fighting your own brother, but an extended family, a dynasty, a clan. And so this is a battle between different members of an extended clan. The grandfather of one side, you'll see his name, it's hard to pronounce there, it's hard to read, I know, in the first verse, the translation, Dhritarashtra. He's an old man, and his sons are on one side, and on the other side are his nephews. He was supposed to be taking care of his nephews after their father, or his brother, died prematurely. But he was so determined that his own sons would run the kingdom, even though by order of succession, his nephews were supposed to have inherited the kingdom. So this whole battle started. And he's asking, Dhritarashtra is asking his secretary, what's happening on the battlefield? They're my sons out there. They're the other sons, my nephews, the sons of Pandu. They've all assembled at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight. What's going to happen now? One thing, bear in mind, it might be surprising for you. This old man, Dhritarashtra, and his secretary, Sanjaya, they're not on the battlefield. They're away. Yet, he's asking his secretary what's going on. Because his secretary has the ability that you all call remote viewing now. In other words, remote viewing is considered to be no big deal in Bhagavad Gita. Sanjaya, even though away from the battlefield, the secretary, even though away from the battlefield, could see exactly what was going on. So the king, Dhritarashtra, he's asking him, tell me, with your remote viewing vision, what are the opposing sides doing on the battlefield? How many of you know something about remote viewing? One? Okay, I'll explain. Now, two. Yes. It's when it's a psychic power by which someone can see something great physical distances away and tell you what's going on. Sounds a bit far-fetched, doesn't it? That you could be sitting in this room and see what's going on in Christ Church or even Los Angeles. That sounds a bit fairy tale-ish. But you'd be surprised. The U.S. government, the CIA, invested millions of dollars gathering psychic persons with disability in California during the Cold War to have them try to see into Russian nuclear sites. Yes, spent millions of dollars. It's not hocus pocus, it's all documented. And these psychics, they would sit in California. And some of them were so powerful, they would tell what's going on at the secret nuclear bases in Russia. And they would describe everything. So, you see, Bhagavad Gita is not so far-fetched after all. The secretary, Sanjaya, is doing the same thing. He's, from afar, seeing what's going on in the battlefield, and he's telling the old man, Dhritarashtra, what are your sons going to do? What are your nephews going to do? Now, the old man's a bit worried. He knows Kurukshetra is a holy place of a pilgrimage. If you go to India now and you ask about Kurukshetra, everyone knows It's a holy place. So the old man was worried. My sons and my nephews are about to fight on a holy place. I'm worried. Why? Because of the influence of the holy place, maybe they'll become peaceful and they won't fight. That's what he was thinking. Maybe this holy place will fill them with dharma and they'll decide to be nonviolent. So that was his anxiety. Therefore, he's asking, what are they going to do? Now, I'll read the Sanskrit. As I said, the sound vibration is very uplifting. Chittarastu vacha dharma chetre kuru chetre samavetaya yutsava mamaka pandavas chaiva kimmaturvata sanjaya. Okay. So, I explained the translation. The old man, Dhritarashtra, is asking his secretary, Sanjaya, my sons and my nephews, the sons of Pandu, they've assembled in this place of pilgrimage, Kurukshetra, desiring to fight. So what did they do? What's going to happen? Now we'll read some of the commentary, which is there so that you get an understanding of the depths of what you're reading. Purport. Bhagavad Gita is the widely read theistic science summarized in the Gita Mahatmya, glorification of the Gita. There it says that one should read Bhagavad Gita very scrutinizingly with the help of a person who is a devotee of Sri Krishna and try to understand it without personally motivated interpretations. All right, what's a personally motivated interpretation? It means I got everything already figured out, and let's see how I can read this text according to what's in my mind. That's a personally motivated interpretation. Rather than approaching the text, approaching the open book like an open book, a clear mind. Without having any preconceptions, without trying to twist things that maybe are a little bit uncomfortable or unconventional for you to hear. All right. The example of clear understanding is there in the Bhagavad Gita itself, in the way that teaching is understood by Arjuna, who heard the Gita directly from the Lord. If someone is fortunate enough to understand Bhagavad Gita in that line of disciplic succession without motivated interpretation, then he surpasses all studies of Vedic wisdom and all scriptures of the world. One will find in the Bhagavad Gita all that is contained in other scriptures, but the reader will also find things which are not to be found elsewhere. That is the specific standard of the Gita. It is the perfect theistic science because it is directly spoken by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. All right, we'll stop there for now. I want to ask you, how do you feel about the issue of violence, nonviolence, and spirituality? What do you think? Whenever there's some question of a battle, it has to be materialistic. Just like now you have the concept of the jihad, the holy war. Of course, a few hundred years ago you had the crusades. Not like the militant Muslims were the only ones who did holy wars. So, what about this controversy? See, from the very beginning, Bhagavad Gita is provoking you. War, battles. How can a spiritual book be spoken in these circumstances? What do you think?
It's possibly something the human race has to go through, because although we're spirits, we're inhabiting a physical form. and perhaps we choose to come to the physical dimension to experience physical things. And as a physical being, we don't come into conflict physically, which we call violence. And if we were beyond that, then possibly we wouldn't be here.
So are you saying that basically, as long as we have these material bodies, there's going to be clashes?
In our evolutionary path so far, there has been. Hopefully one day there won't, but I'm not quite sure how far off that will be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, did you know a statistic that the past century, the 20th century, was the most violent century in recorded history since 1 AD. In other words, in the past 2,000 years, the century we just finished had more people killed in violent conflicts in that century than all the other 1900 years. Progress. Advancement. Yes. In 100 years, more people died from combat than, you know, the previous 1900 years. Now, how is that for progress? How is that for our ego in terms of, oh, never before has mankind been so advanced. Any other thoughts about war and spirituality?
It's a reflection of the mind, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a reflection of the mind.
What's a reflection of the mind?
Wars and battles.
Can you explain that a little?
Well, you've got conflict going in your mind all the time, so that it presents itself.
That's very interesting.
In everyday life as well.
That's a very interesting point. That because people have battles inside themselves, naturally these battles inside are going to come out. Yes. This is a very important spiritual instruction given in the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita. It's a text called Srimad Bhagavatam. How can you have peace when people have all these battles within? You have persons who cannot control their own mind and senses. They haven't conquered their mind and senses within, yet they want to conquer things outside of them. So, the message of Bhagavad Gita is first conquer the enemies within, then worry about the so-called enemies without. Now I must add that in this situation, in this battle, it's not a metaphor for the battle within. This is the actual battle without. But it is based on some person's lack of ability to control their enemies within. One side didn't want to fight this war, even though they had a right to fight. The other side wanted to fight because they were greedy. So this greed is one of the enemies within. And if you can't conquer the enemies within, there's going to be no peace without. That is the essential message of Bhagavad Gita. Any more thoughts on war and spirituality?
I think war happens due to spirituality when certain groups of people say that our spiritual way is superior to other people's, instead of just saying our way is different and their way is different. And when they try to change other people into their way.
Could you give an example?
Oh, like you mentioned the holy wars, for example, the Christian crusades. That's essentially saying that Christianity is a better way than other people's ways. And probably the same for every holy war.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of people blame it on religion just under that banner, but it's not really the original religion of scripture, it's men's faulty interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, crusades didn't come to change the religion of those people, that was not the war for them, it was for freeing the grace of God from non-believers. That was the, at least, advertised message to get a soldier, mm-hmm. even though the unlike reason might be to for business purposes to have a business card from west to east, etc., etc. But they didn't claim they are going to change those people to Christians.
Often this depends on which side of the gun you're on, what the reality is. Now, you're mentioning a very interesting thing about how you feel that when people think my religion is the way and you've got to take it up. But let's just broaden the definition of religion and not just look at, let's say, everyone's fearful of militant Islam today. But what about Hollywood? Take it as a religion. Suppose you're living in a traditional tribal village in the Middle East, and you take your traditional ways very seriously, and Hollywood movies and satellite TV, you know, The Sopranos and Sex in the City, you know, shows up, you know, throughout your land. isn't that kind of like a holy war? You know, McDonald's opening up everywhere.
They have a good justification for it. They say those people living in very poor conditions, they don't have a TV, they're not educated, so we must help them. So they change their lifestyle, give them TV sets, and
and they live happily ever after.
And they have good purpose for it.
And they live happily ever after, right?
No.
So this is the point. I think we have to be a bit fair without, you know, letting anyone off the hook. Still, the fact is everybody's pushing something. Some people are pushing their so-called religion, convert or die. Others are pushing their another kind of religion. Just open up your markets. Open up your TV sets. Here we come. Just like I myself, I've been based in New Zealand for about 11 years. This place is so different than it was when I first came in 93. So different in that I see the effects that American movies, American television have had. Very different. The innocence has diminished. Now some people might say that's a good thing. We want to be a part of the global market. Okay, but that also may have its disadvantages too. In any case, my point is not to get into the rights or wrongs of this ism or that ism. My point is to show you that people do have agendas, even those who say they're not religious, they have an agenda. And so it often seems that the world is a place of clashing between different agendas, whether you call them this ism or that ism. So, in other words, I wouldn't just lay blame at whatever people think a particular religion is. That this is causing wars. Does anyone else comment on war and spirituality?
No, I think that a spiritual person can fight a war because everyone else is on the contrary, but I think that it depends on the reason that you fight the war. If you are a spiritual person, you don't fight for your own benefit or benefit of your desires or whatever. You fight for justice or something like that, and whatever it might be.
That's an interesting point. Let's get back to it. Oh, by the way, we should all introduce ourselves just so we know each other. My name is Devamrita Swami. I am here from time to time. I do a lot of traveling. I've been traveling on every continent of the world for about 25 years now. So, New Zealand is my turnaround point. And I've been involved with this application of ancient wisdom in the contemporary world for about 30 years now. over 30 years. So that's what I do. Maybe you can introduce yourself?
My name is Gabriela. I'm a student.
From?
I'm originally from Czech Republic.
Oh, yes. Okay. You're staying here now?
Yes, I'm staying.
My name is Xiaobi. They have sent me here by force. So, I'm finally ready to get out.
I'm Ellie, and I'm from Sweden.
I'm Joe. Yeah, I'm from Scotland. I'm here from Sailor.
You're here?
I'm a sailor.
Ah.
I'm here for about 6 months.
You stay?
No. No, I'm traveling.
Ah, okay. A bit warmer than Scotland, yeah?
No.
No? Yeah. My mother's side of my family is from Scotland. I've never been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Todd. That's a Scottish name, Todd. Mm-hmm. Yes. Scotland by way of Bermuda. Yes. You see, you know, the Tropic Isle, the picturesque Tropic Isle of Bermuda was empty. And then the Scottish government decided they needed a place to send their mischievous soldiers for punishment. So they picked out this deserted island, Bermuda. So, and when the soldiers got there, they said, wow, what a punishment! You know, pink sands, blue water. So, naturally, to make the punishment even better, the punished soldiers had to bring in some women from the nearby islands to make the punishment complete. And so in that way, that's how my mother's side of the family came about. So I offer my respects to Scott. You can see it a bit in palms. Yes.
I'm Russian. Which
part of Russia are you from?
Actually from Bolshevik, which is down south.
Near?
It's towards the east. It's on the east coast. So my father's side is from Bolshevik.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's from Kerala, which is on the other side.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you're living here now?
Yeah, I'm living here.
Okay.
My name is Peter. I'm from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
Although I've been away for a while, I'm back here for a short time and about to head off again.
Ah.
With work as well.
And the work keeps you traveling.
Yes.
Okay. How long have you been traveling for?
This time, just coming up 2 years.
Ah, so you started traveling about 2 years ago? Or even
it comes in fits and starts. I can't even stay in one place too long. Very bored with New Zealand at times. Especially the climate.
My name is Aidan, and I did the science.
Yeah. Okay.
It's my job.
Wow, very nice. And you're from?
I'm from Auckland.
Okay. So you're a sign maker?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
My name is Matt. I'm from around here, mostly.
Around how often?
Yeah,
studying teaching?
Yeah.
Which subject?
Everything. Primary school kids.
Primary school? Yeah. Oh, you like little kids, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice that there are many like little kids. Very good. Most ladies who have children tell me that the man doesn't really like dealing with the child until the child's about 8 years old and the child can do something intelligent, otherwise it's all the mother's world. Was that true of you?
I think so.
coming in the other way, and they like them in their, you know, keep the family in their contracts and the
outdoor. Okay.
My name is Valera, and I'm from Russia as well. From Siberia.
Which city?
Siberia, Irkutsk.
I go as far as Omsk. That's as far. The Urals. I go there regularly. I spend about 5 months a year in Russia. Based in St. Petersburg.
What's the coldest temperature you've been to?
I avoid those times of the year. That's right here now. In the summer, quote unquote summer, I go to Murmansk. That's above the Arctic Circle. And but otherwise, sometimes I go there in January, February, but I try to avoid it too. I think the coldest I've seen is 25 below zero. It gets worse in Siberia, yes. 40 below. You're living here now?
Yeah.
Okay. Bit of a different climate, though.
Yeah. The houses are colder, though.
Right. Everyone from Russia says that about New Zealand, that it takes them a while to get used to the cold, because in Russia, although it's 40 below zero outside, they keep the heat inside cranked up so high, it's
weird. No, just the houses are built properly.
The heat is so high.
I'm from Czech, we don't have such a low temperature, but still I come from New Zealand, which is supposed to be warm, and I'm so cold all the time.
Yes, because the houses aren't insulated.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there.
Yeah. So it's amazing that someone from a country where it gets to be 40 below zero in the winter feels cold when they come here. That's because in Russia, they just inside the house is a furnace. It's so, so hot. All right.
I'm Chris, I'm a physiotherapist, and I'm doing this now.
Okay. Some of the persons here are part-time staff members. Some of you might know them. You can introduce yourself.
Annette Smith.
And you're from?
Yeah. Right.
I'm Benedictine from France.
France? Okay.
I'm Sajinata from London. And the next door actually.
Auckland or the North Shore? I've always heard the mantra about that. There are two types of people who live in Auckland. Those who live on the North Shore and those who want to live on the North Shore. You heard that one? Where are you from? Really? Really? Where?
Oh, not the
one she goes
to.
In Christchurch?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. What is
the name?
Fire Crisis. Oh, okay. Fire Crisis, I agree. All right. So, now, your point. You're saying that. By the way, you said you're from Czech Republic. I spent many years underground teaching Bhagavad-gita in the Czech Republic during communist days, from 78 to 86. I used to know my way around Prague very easily. I just went back there for early this year for the first time since communist days. All right. Can you say some instances where you feel war is justified? You said that, well, there are times when...
No, what I wanted to say was that one can be a spiritual person and still be involved in war if it is for if it is not for fulfilling his own desires or something like that. I don't think that the war is justified. Maybe suppose self-defense, you know, war, if you're attacked, you can fight back or something like that, but there is no justification from the other side to attack or something like that. So in general case, I think the war shouldn't be happening. But I think that if the person is on the right side, then it is justified.
The right side. Now, what's the right side?
Suppose if you are defending yourself.
Oh, self-defense.
For example, if I come and attack you, I believe you have a right to defend yourself.
Everyone here agrees that if someone attacks you, you have a right to defend yourself. You would consider that appropriate? Anyone disagree? Do you have anyone here who would just let yourself be attacked because you're completely against any kind of violence? Anyone like that? But suppose you couldn't run away, you had no choice. Huh?
No.
Right. Okay, so everyone agrees on that. Self-defense.
Suppose there are different kinds of self-defense, because you can self-defense with the intention of inflicting pain on the other person, or you can just defend yourself just to avoid having harm done to yourself. So like a vengeful self-defense or self-defense for the sake of self-defense.
I give an example. Something happened to my father. He was a bureaucrat in the police department in New York City. And the requirement there is that even when a policeman is off duty, even if he's not someone who's on patrol, even if he's in the office, he's not, you know, he's a bureaucrat, you know, like that. Still, if you see a crime when you're off duty, you've got to intervene. I don't know, is that like that in New Zealand police? Yeah. When you're off duty. Anyway, New York, you may be off duty, but if you see a crime and you're any kind of member of the police department, you know, high ranking or just a patrol person, you've got to do something. And you have to carry a gun all the time. So you had to carry, he has a small off duty gun, he had to carry it all the time, whether he went to church or this, or whatever. So he was driving off duty, and then he saw a man running after some teenagers, and the man had a gun in his hand. It turned out later that these teenagers had tried to crash his party, and so, you know, in the USA everyone has a right to bear arms, so, it's an essential right, you know. So, this man, you know, started chasing him up the street, you know, with a gun. So my father told me, he pulled over the car, and he came out of the car, and showed his badge, he has to carry his badge, and told the man, halt. And the man looked at him, and then turned around, and he was close enough to my father, and he stuck his gun in my father's chest. So my father, trained as he was, with one hand he pushed the man's hand away, and then he drew his own gun and had to fire point blank at the man. So he was shot in the stomach, and the man died shortly thereafter. So my father was very upset about it, that he was 2 weeks off. He was lucky to have gotten off like that in terms of not being, you know, killed himself. So, yes, everyone recognized that self-defense. First of all, he probably saved these teenagers who tried to crash the party from, you know, getting their just desserts. Anyway, everyone agrees. Okay, I can understand. His life was threatened. He was trying to intervene for upholding the laws of society and had his life threatened in the process. He had to defend himself. He didn't mean to kill the man, but what can you do if someone shows a gun in your stomach? You know, you don't have much time to figure out to what extent should my response be, you know. It's just, you know, law of self-preservation. So, what about other instances, though? Because at first you mentioned war, violence for the right purpose. Are there any other right purposes?
Suppose, like you said, in the example of your father, he was intervening. Mm-hmm. and he was ready to, or police should be ready to stop crime, so even by violent means.
He wasn't ready to stop crime by violent means, no.
No, police generally does. Suppose if somebody's dead, they are ready to shoot the guy or use some kind of force or whatever.
I don't know, the fight that museum. I don't think so.
I think hanging up a person is a violent action, especially if the person is not happy for that. So.
That's a good interesting point you raise, because recently, let's see, last year, I had something stolen from me in Australia, in Perth. And amazingly, the police almost apprehended the persons. And they caught three of them, and the fourth person started running. Three persons, they had my laptop and some other electronic things, and the fourth person had my passport and documents like that. So that person with just the documents started running. And so the police, the Australian police just told me, well, you know, when they run, you know, in this country we don't press it any further, you know. Whereas it's true, in the USA, if someone runs from a policeman, first he says, halt. And then if they don't halt, he does have the right to administer force. That way, very few people in the USA run from a policeman. But it was interesting. In Australia, the policeman just told me, look, you know, when they run, you know. I said, well, you know, can't you at least threaten, you know, because they do carry guns in Australia, I believe, don't they? Yes, yeah. I said, well, can't you just pull your gun and, you know, it's too much paperwork, and every time we pull out our gun, we got to fill out a whole sheet of papers, you know. It's a bit too much. Well, it's interesting. Whereas in the USA, when the policeman says halt, you halt. No criminals run. They may turn and fire with their own gun, but they will not run. Because they know as soon as they run, the police have a right. You know, generally, the police will shoot you in the leg. Because their police are knowing, why are you running? First of all, it's illegal to run from a policeman. Secondly, obviously, you're hiding something. So, yeah, it's interesting. But in that case of my father, he had no intention of just pulling out his gun because they were breaking the law. He only pulled out his gun in self-defense.
Yeah, but the rule that he has to carry a gun is implying that he can use it at those times, because that rule is involved also with the, you know, stopping the crime, etc.
Any other thoughts about that?
What about if you're a kid brought up in Palestine and your family and friends are telling you that to go and blaze up in Israel or give you a spot in heaven?
And so
is it the person, is it the kid that's in the wrong, or is it?
Now, what would you say?
So it's the motivation behind it.
Actually, I know what they tell the kids, part of what they tell the kids. They consider it to be religious belief that, for if you're a young boy, once you're blown up, you go to heaven and you get 33 virgins, all yours. So what about it?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's just another instance of war that's just happens and it keeps on cycling over.
They feel that this is our land. Israelis say, no, this is our land. So, what to do?
What to do? That's the question.
Any other? Reasons why war would be justified?
I don't think in case of spirituality it really is, because spirituality involves nothing worldly, and even if other people want the peace of the world, why not? The world is not really the goal of a spiritual person.
It's a very good point. In fact, we're going to find out that is one of the arguments given by this warrior who didn't want to fight. He said, even if the other side is so hell-bent, why do we have to follow suit? Just because they are avaricious, just because they are greedy, why is it that we have to get into this? The other side is wrong, but still, why do we have to be involved? Why can't we just walk away? Interesting point. So are there any, besides self-defense, are there any reasons why violence, war, would be justified?
I believe when the standard of, there are two types of war. One is very simple, for Americans go there, kill Iraqis to steal their oil, that's for money, so you have to self-defense. Another one is, if the standards of God are being broken, and I have the power, it's justified to go, and like the policeman, halt, to stop being, stop breaking laws of God. If they continue, and I have the power, I won't fight. So in this case, it is justified. I think.
If the standards of God,
if the standards are being broken by Hollywood and mass propagation and everything that they are doing, if I have power, it's justified to go and fight.
All right. Now, who decides what the laws of God are?
There are not too many books. It's this one, it's Bible, and it's Quran. There are three. The standards of God in all three are the same.
Interesting. Any comments?
I don't understand the God of what we have interpreted to be the standard of God. I think it's quite different to what the Bible teaches.
No, they are not.
For the simple reason, his overall principles, which we are inherently born with, to not want to do harm to other people, but in terms of the standard of God, there's many, many standards of God, depending on which religion you want to follow. And the key thing for the people at the pyramid of that religion is to keep the flock believing in that. Because if they don't, they lose control.
Oh, you have a good government.
Well, no, the church.
Or a big government. Or Hollywood.
Yeah. And they have to keep control. But we know,
or a big university.
We know what the standards of God are. We don't need a book to learn that. And this is where the holy wars are so confusing to young people, because supposedly they are spiritual wars, but the God force is certainly not, as I was taught by in a Christian church at school. I've come to learn that was just a means of control, and I would say that follows on to many religions, simply because one of the main things is that in the Christian religion they teach that God is judgmental, which I believe is not true. The God force is cannot be judgmental because it's a universal force. It follows universal laws. It doesn't know what good and what bad is. That's our interpretation on things that we consider good or bad. So it is quite different.
What about, since you brought up Iraq, the recent invasion of Iraq when it first started, the general who was commanding the forces, he since retired, his name was Tommy Franks, and his wife described that when they're back at the base in the USA, every morning before her husband leaves the house to go to work, in that case his work is to run the whole military operation, as he's walking out the door, you know, she kisses him goodbye, and then whispers every morning in his ear, "Honey, make the world a safer place for democracy."
Islands.
I mean, isn't that a higher purpose? Make the world a safer place for democracy. Yeah, she's inspiring her man.
Behind every great man is a woman. Old saying. Now they say alongside or in front of. In New Zealand you say in front of. So anyway, the point is, She's making an inspiring statement. What do you think? What? Honey, make the world a safer place for democracy. Every morning. It's like your husband, he's a land developer. He's involved in land development like that. Yes. Can you imagine as he's going out the door every morning, you give him a kiss and say, honey, make the world a better place for capitalism. Can you imagine yourself doing that? So my point is to show you there's different isms, you know, in this world. It's not just what we call religion. There's also a lot of other competing isms, you know. Even when you get into the university, the academic fields, you'll find there's a lot of isms being propagated. There's a knowledge filter. Certain knowledge that is very challenging has a hard time making itself known. That's just the way it is. People naturally resist things that challenge their worldview. This is one of the areas of my study, how conventional knowledge resists any kind of paradigm change. I briefly was talking at the beginning of our session about the story of human antiquity, how there can be quite some contrary evidence to that. But if you're accustomed to viewing human history a certain way, you don't want to hear it. But anyway, let's continue a little bit longer about this. I know it's a contentious, very uncomfortable theme. Can there be war for any good spiritual purpose? So far, everyone agrees on self-defense. But beyond that, doesn't seem like... And we have one of our guests pointing out the laws of God. Otherwise, everyone else was pretty quiet. So I brought up the example about democracy. If everyone has a vote, then everything is okay. Open up your markets, open up your ballot boxes. Everything will be fine in your country. That's another ism. Now, what about this battle in Kurukshetra? Let's deal with this battle. Said to have happened 5,000 years ago. One side wanted to fight. That's the side of the old man, Dhritarashtra, and he was asking his secretary, Sanjaya. It's page 35. What are my sons going to do? And what are the sons of Pandu, the other guys, what are they going to do? It's all one big extended family, but still, the family is split. The old man wants his son to be king. He doesn't want his nephews, who are supposed to be king. He doesn't want them. So therefore, the family has this big fight going on. Now, one side is very eager to fight. The other side is not eager to fight at all, but is doing it out of duty. Now, why was it duty? First of all, this other side was being attacked. It was self-defense. Their wife, their wives had been attacked. Their property had been stolen. They were actually fighting for their very existence. So it was complete self-defense. Secondly, both parties were of the Vedic martial class, just like in Greek civilization, which according to the standpoint of Bhagavad Gita, Greek civilization, ancient Roman civilization, ancient Greek civilization, is recent. There was a martial class. So this is what you're dealing with here. You're not dealing with, you know, young boys and students and accountants, you know, drafted into the army. You're dealing with professional soldiers who actually like to fight for the right purpose. And the right purpose is protection, to protect the innocent. That's their occupational calling when executed properly. So the other side, the side that didn't want to fight, they were
pushed to the brink of extermination by the other side. And so they were fighting out of self-defense, and they were also, as noble persons, they were knowing that if we don't stand up to these tyrants, people will suffer. And as professional warriors, it's our duty to protect the innocent, even at the expense of our life. I think you see still a bit of that in medieval times, the classic idealistic conception of the knight in shining armor protecting the downtrodden. This is what's going on here. So the soldiers on the peaceful side, they're reluctantly engaging in battle. First of all, self-defense. Secondly, they know if we allow this other side to go on with their plans, the innocent population will suffer. So you have to take that into account when reading Bhagavad Gita. You're not dealing with military conscription and innocent people being pressed into the army and saying, fight now, point your gun this way. You're dealing with a martial class, a warrior class, whose duty it is to protect the innocent. So, in the ancient Vedic civilization that Bhagavad Gita is based on, these civilians were never involved in war. These soldiers, the professional martial class, would go to some remote area, have it out, and whichever side won, that's who the citizens would accept as their government. That way, the citizens were never involved in combat. Whereas, what does war mean nowadays in the most advanced times of today, the pinnacle of human civilization? What does war mean? Kill the women and children. These are the statistics I was just seeing this last week, statistics that millions of children are dying in conflicts in this present day. In fact, just like in the Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia, when there was war, it was the women who were harassed. So this kind of war mentioned in Bhagavad Gita is nothing like that. It's between two groups of professional warriors, and it's taking place in a remote area.